understanding from countries Russia. We have got two Abdul Qatari and just today the couple of presentation the affirmation of the fourth member of parliament and the processing of the ISA legislation. Without wasting time, we will start with the Sakrisa presentation one. But it's our normal procedure in Parliament before we start any business of the day to introduce ourselves to everybody who is visiting us so that we also know who they are themselves and where they can help us in the future. Where we can find them. So, well, now some of you have already mentioned the code of interaction, but it is always also a parliamentary protocol because if I'm talking, what I'm talking is being recorded. So everybody who uses the mic or who is doing any talk here in Parliament must talk to the micro. That is why most of the sessions of Parliament are going to be authorized if they go out of Parliament because they're going to be recorded. So without waste of time, I'll start from my desk. I'm Naban Moho. My English name is Eugene, but it's actually used in Parliament. I'm the chairperson of the Science and Technology Portfolio Committee. And of course, the committee secretary, Shahnaz Isaacs, who looks at the matters of the committee schedule, or if we agree with anything for the future arrangements, she takes care of that. And then on my right here, I've got our content specialist, who is Dr. Remy Osman-Marins, who looks after the content and direction of our committee. Sometimes I usually have the assistant secretary, but she is in and out. Not around. Okay. I'll then allow the members to introduce themselves so that you can hear also their voices.
Thank you. Morning, Chair. I'm here, the week of can you introduce myself? I'm finding something I would have thought you would have spoken about. So let me be out of order for a bit. But today's presentation is more than 50% of men in this committee today. Something that's back my education. I just wanted to let me talk about that before I present it.
But it's not 60. If you look at it, it's only 1% man. Okay.
Good morning. My name is Janita Flockers-Lowden. It's an IWGZ at the end. I've got
there, everybody. And booking
morning, all. My name is Peter Smith. From KZN. Representing me. I'm going to sleep more. I don't know what the member of the Portfolio Committee is in the chief by then. And coming from the OR Tambo region, representing the ANC.
I'll also allow the delegation from GSC to introduce themselves.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Martin Mukherjee. I'm Special Advisor to Minister Ankar.
Morning, everyone. I'm Sharma Natu. I'm the parliamentary liaison officer for the ministry. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. This is Claudina Lewis. I'm the Director for Health Innovation at Science and Technology.
Let me just see now. I think I'll pick up our important guest, the person who introduced themselves, which is Austin Aisa.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Kumelele Nzimande, Chair of the SSRC Board.
And Olive Shesana from the HSRC CEO.
Good morning, Chair and everybody. I am Pindile Kelolo from the Africa Institute of South Africa.
Good morning, my name is Thomas Vele, Professor of International Health, and I serve as Senior Program Advisor at the HSRC.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Christopher and I'm from SEBNET.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Moses Mwabe. I'm a researcher on HIV and AIDS Portfolio Committee at Parliament.
But I'm what's called the protocol chair together with Linda Gray. 0.001 study. And just to say that I think one of the exciting things from CAPRISA is that CAPRISA has handed the mantle of expanding this research to a broad range of researchers in the country, and so Dan and I are heading that research effort. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Shuri Shamdulkarim, and I was the principal investigator of the CAPRISA 004 trial that was proof of concept that Jean-Paul Bajal can prevent HIV infection. I'm also associate scientific director of the Center for the AIDS program of research in South
Africa. Good morning, everyone. My name is Bethana Pastor. I come from Bulindlela, an area where the Pinafuta Gel was in charge. And I am a coordinator for the CIFUNA campaign, which is a campaign that is trying to put pressure on the researchers, on the policy decision makers, on medicine control council to make it, to fast track the process of getting the germ to the women. And we are trying to bridge the gap between science and the community, because the community does not understand what science is doing.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Leila Mansour. I'm a senior scientist at CAPRISA, was involved with the CAPRISA 004 Jean-Paul Bajal trial. I coordinated that study. And as we move into the implementation science trial, I'm the co-principal investigator on that study.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Kathleen Gaddy. I'm with CAPRISA. I'm a project leader at the Clean Science Network and I'm the international science staff for Jean-Paul Bajal.
Good morning, I'm Jenna Gray. I'm a research professor at the Prenatal HIV Research Unit at the University of Witwatersrand. I'm also at the Office of AIDS Research at the Medical Research Council. And with together with Helen, I am part of leadership for the SAC-001 study. Helen will present soon.
Thank you very much, Nadine, for those introductions. So without much further ado, what I want to do is sketch out what has happened in the last 2.5 years or so. I have to say, before I start, I felt somewhat disorientated this morning, because whenever I come to Parliament, I have to see Chief of Executive. And this morning, he wasn't there. We normally have our catch-up on the morning flight from Durham. But it's wonderful to have this opportunity to address the honorable members on the Jean-Paul Bajal research and where we are progressing. So since we last met in Durban and Bulawayo, there has been very substantial scientific progress on the use of antiretrovirals for HIV prevention. More significantly, there have now been a total of 7 studies since the CAPRISA-004 study, which have all systematically shown that the use of antiretrovirals can prevent the onset of HIV. And it has now been studied in many different kinds of populations, in many different kinds of formulations. So they have been among the formulations tested, tenofovir as a tablet, tenofovir in combination with amphotericin in a tablet called Truvada, and the tenofovir gel formulation. So all 3 of them have been tested. They've been tested in discordant couples, they've been tested in the general population, they've been tested in men who have sex with men. They've been tested in injecting drug users. And across the board, what we've seen from all these results, the most recent of which is to come out of Thailand on injecting drug use, which we expect the results to be released in about 2 months' time, what we have seen systematically from these studies is that in those individuals who use these drugs, they are able to get the benefit of very substantial levels of HIV protection. We have also seen the flip side of the problem, that we have, in certain instances, difficulty in getting people to use these products when they do not volunteer of their own will to use these products. We've seen them that particularly occur in 2 studies. One is called FEMPEP, and the other one is called VOID. In both those studies, the challenge that was experienced by the investigators, we were trying to understand their results, is what we have seen is that very few of the men and women who participated in the study use the product, you can actually have it. And it's the same with treatment, it's the same with vaccines. You have to use the product. If you want to benefit from antiretrovirals, if you have HIV patients, you've got to use the product. So when you use the product, we have now shown, and this comes from several studies now, is that we can get levels of protection that can achieve incredibly high levels. And when we look at analyses of all of these studies in relation to drug levels, where we measure the amount of drug that's present in the blood or in the vagina, we're able to see incredibly high levels of protection in the range of 90 to 93%. Where we are analyzing the data based on women and men who have used and not used the product, then we get efficacy coming down to around 40, 50%. The two big studies that have been the most compelling have been in this one, coupled with a very high incentive to use these tablets. And those studies we saw connection levels in the range of 70%. So what we know now, and what has been confirmed through the US FDA, is that Truvada, when taken every day as a tablet, is effective in preventing HIV and is now licensed for that purpose. Mm-hmm. Tenofovir gel is still one step behind Truvada because Truvada had two studies that were able to show protection. They were able to proceed to licensure. In the situation of tenofovir gel, we do not have the results from two separate independent studies available to proceed to licensure. So we have met with the US FDA, we have met with the MCC, and their requirement is that it has to be two studies that show protection. And so you're going to hear shortly from Professor Lee about why that one study would be done and what it means. I'm going to ask Leila to give each of you now an applicator with an offer gel. This is the applicators we are using currently in the 008 trial. And what I would like you to do is to get a feel of the product itself and where we are in terms of, I'm going to briefly look at where we are in terms of trying to improve on this product. So what you have in your hands, or will have in your hands shortly, is what we call a first generation product. And this is the product we would like to proceed with to licensure. But as we do that, we are already working on developing several new agents that would either be easier to use or more efficacious. So if you look at this tenofovir gel applicator, it comes in the overlap that ensures that it seals nicely so that it can be no contamination. I'd like you just to take it over. Just from the top, just take it over. You'll see inside there's an applicator. And there's a separate plunger. And the reason we don't put the plunger in the applicator is we don't want people accidentally to plunge it while taking it out of the packaging. So you just take the plunger and you insert it at the top. But here, you feel a kick. That means the plunger is now in place. If you take the blue cap, you've got to take the blue cap off. So if you can just take the blue cap, it just screws off. You just take the blue cap off. And once you've taken the blue cap off, if you just plunge it onto your palm, it's quite big, I can assure you. You get a feel of what this product looks like. Exactly what tenofovir gel is. You can see it is clear, colorless, smelling, odorless. I tasted it, and I can tell you, it has no taste. And this particular product, the whole idea behind it is that we want to empower women who want to use it, regardless of what their men's opinion is. In our study, most men have been supportive of its use. But in the event that women would like to use it, and they would like to use it confidentially, this product enables them to do that. The total volume we are using in this product is 4 mL, and in using 4 mL, we get an adequate dose of tenofovir in order to prevent HIV. When HIV HIV is in the vagina, it is trying to target a very specific cell. The cell has a specific receptor called the CD4 receptor. And in these cells, what we want to do is we want to ensure that they have to muffler before HIV gets to them. And what we have seen is once you've inserted the gel, within 15 minutes, Tenofovir gets into those particular target cells. And it remains there for a total of 3 up to 5 days, depending on the half-life of the individual. So it's that goal that we are trying to achieve. We are trying to get the target cells for HIV, CD4 positive cells in the vagina. We're trying to prepare them to be able to fight HIV when HIV comes along. So on that note, I'd like to now invite Professor Lee to tell you about since the completion of the O4 study where we showed proof of concept that tenofovir gel works in preventing HIV. Where are we now on the path to light?
Thank you very much, and thank you for this opportunity. So I want to just pick up on something that Slim said, which was what we're really keen to do, is to develop a technology that empowers women. And in the same way that you identified a colleague that you didn't see on the plane, I met a colleague who I worked on in the 1980s on Speak Magazine. We got together on Speak Magazine, which was a magazine for women in the trade union movement, which aimed to empower women. And you know, years later, we're still doing the same thing. We've moved on in the way that we're doing what we do, but this is the aim of what we're doing. I'm presenting this now on behalf of myself and Glenda. We are the co-chairs of the FACT-001 study. What I'm going to do, we thought it would be helpful to explain what the study looks like and how it's designed, and also how we implement the study and how progress is getting on. So some of the slides might look a bit technical. I'm going to talk at quite high level to them, but people are very welcome to ask questions that you might want to ask. So this outline, why we're doing FACT-001, we heard that COMPLETE-004 was successful and showed a positive result. So I'm going to explain why we have to do a second trial and then describe the trial. I'm going to talk about the next 2 points, really. The VOID study that Slim also mentioned, that has been a challenge to us because it was a disappointment. It didn't show the positive results. But what it taught us about the importance of adherence in a trial and why we're really working on that. And then we have an oversight board for all of these big studies who are independent scientists. And I'll end by just sharing with you what they have said to us about the continuation of the trial. This was a study that we published in 2005 on a household survey of 15 to 24-year-old girls and boys. And you can see in the purple that the incidence of HIV in the age groups, if you go from the age of 15 up to the age of 21 and then on to 24, you can see that extraordinarily steep rise of HIV in this age group in young women. And sadly, this was published in 2005, but we're still seeing that same curve occurring. And we really need these new technologies. South Africa desperately needs them, and we need a South African effort to get them. And this is what we're looking at. Just to remind ourselves, the COMPLETE-004 results were extraordinarily exciting. It was the first vaginal microbicide that had shown effect. It was overall 39% effective, but about 54% effective in the women who used the gel really well and according to instructions. It also showed a reduction in herpes, and herpes is another sexually transmitted infection that is a major problem in our community. In your slides, I've changed the order. I put this in here. It's in your slide pack, but I thought it would be useful at this point to remind ourselves what regimen is being used, both in COMPLETE-004 and the regimen that we are repeating now in the FACT-001. So this regimen we call BAT24, and the difference between this and other studies that I'll mention is that this gel is being used around the time of sex. So the women are instructed to use the gel up to 12 hours, so within a 12-hour period before sex. It doesn't have to be 12 hours on the nail, it can be any time in that 12-hour period. And then to insert another gel, a second gel, as soon as they can after sex, but again within 12 hours. So two gels, one before, one after, within a 24-hour period, but no more than two doses in 24 hours. This is what COMPLETE-004 did, and this is what FACT is repeating.
Now, why are we doing a confirmatory study? And you've heard that from the community point of view, women are really wanting products. And say, why are you having to review them? Well, as we said, we need to confirm now that the findings of the first trial are true and real, because we don't want to license something if we can't confirm it in a second study. The CAPRISA study was excellently executed, but was a relatively small study in terms of overall numbers. And so the estimate of how effective the gel was very wide. And it also showed in that study that the effectiveness of the gel declined between 12 and 18 months. So we wanted to confirm the effectiveness of the gel. Can we repeat and show once again that it's effective against HIV? The other thing is that the... The second thing is, as you know, that this CAPRISA was done in the CAPRISA sites in KwaZulu-Natal. Well, the HIV prevalence and the incidence is the highest in the country, and we've got many places where the HIV prevalence, the amount of HIV amongst women in the community really varies across the country. So we need to confirm that the product will work in women in different parts of the country where the HIV epidemic is different. We also want to look at whether it's safe to use in younger women, because if we can show that this is effective, we want this to be used in any young woman who is at risk of HIV. So we must show that it's safe, and then safe for women with different conditions, such as women in pregnancy. We want to confirm also the finding from CAPRISA that showed that there was a 50 that Norfolk protected against herpes. Herpes is very, very common in our community. It's up to 50% of women in the general community can have herpes. And we know that herpes increases risk of HIV. So if this, we can protect against both herpes and HIV, it's a double bonus. So we're also aiming to confirm that the tenofovir gel reduces herpes, as was shown in the CAPRISA study. So I'm going to now just talk to you. When we write these study protocols, as we call them, we have objectives, and we have one big main objective, and then we have secondary objectives, and you'll see even further objectives. But the big question we're trying to ask is to look at the safety and effectiveness of tenofovir gel, as you've got it in front of you, when it's applied by a woman into the vagina in preventing HIV infection. That's the big question. In addition, we're going to see whether we can confirm that finding that tenofovir gel protects against herpes infection in women. We want to make sure that tenofovir gel is safe, so that if a pregnant woman happens to use it, that there's a good pregnancy outcome. We need to check on that. We also want to see that if women are using different levels of gel and different levels of condom, if they use the gel some of the time but not all of the time, how effective will the gel be at protecting against HIV? And what will happen in terms of the HIV infection when we stop the gel? It's also important because this is an antiretroviral. You all have heard a lot about concerns about resistance to antiretrovirals developing in the community. So for any woman who becomes infected with HIV in the trial, we will look at the impact of using the gel in terms of her disease, her viral load, and we'll also measure tenofovir resistance. Now, in the CAPRISA study, there were no problems with the development of tenofovir resistance. That was not a problem. We want to confirm that indeed that is not going to be a problem if we roll this product out. And then we have a number of what we call exploratory objectives. And I'll just draw your attention to the middle one. So in the study, FACTS-001, we don't only do a clinical trial for the product, but we do a lot of social science research as well, trying to understand women's practices when they're in the study. If they use the gel, do they stop using condoms because they feel protected? We need to check on all of those questions. So it's not just about does the gel work here or no. It's also about what is the impact on behavior, what is acceptability, what is condom use once women start to use it. These are called exploratory objectives. And just to show you how we measure things without going through this slide, you can see that for the primary endpoint, the secondary endpoint, and the exploratory endpoint, we measure different outcomes. And at the end of the trial, we'll be able to report back on all of these questions. Now, when we started the study, we initially started with what we call a sample size. So we had 2,200 women in the sample. But we've now changed the study, and we're now increased the number of women in the sample.
and there will be 2,900 women, if you look at version 4, aged between 18 to 40 years, who will be enrolled in the study. 2,600 women will be in what we really regard as the target age group, which is the 18 to 30 year old age group, because this is the age group where we're seeing that very high rise of HIV infection. So the majority of the women in the study will be in the 18 to 30 year old age group. But we also want to know if it's safe for women who are a bit older, because they will also want to use it. So we're going up to 40 years to get more safety information in that group. And we will enroll women who have either been exposed to herpes or who haven't been exposed to herpes, and we'll be able to analyze the herpes results from that. To give you a sense, and I mentioned this earlier, that from Caprica, which was in KwaZulu-Natal, we try to now expand the reach of the study so that women in many different communities are now going to be using the product. As you can see, the spread of the 9 sites that we now have for those 2,900 women who are being enrolled. And you can see where these sites are. And each site has a comprehensive team of researchers, scientists, clinicians undertaking the study. So you're just seeing two of us representing this particular study here. I should also add, though, that the CAPRISA team has really supported the FACS team. So this has been a really good collaborative effort. And I want to acknowledge Leila in the middle there, who has been outstanding in going to all the fact sites and supporting us in looking at adherence. I'm going to just briefly explain to you something that troubled us and the way that we dealt with it in the study. You might have heard about this study. It was called the VOICE study, and it was a disappointment. This was a very big study done in many different countries in the African region, and it looked at two sorts of antiretroviral tablets and tenofovir gel and said, will they protect against HIV, and all of these three products were being used on a daily basis. And the women were randomly assigned to these groups, and two groups of the women had placebo. So we were able to compare between a placebo group and an active group. And we all expected this to work because the women were taking tablets daily or using the gel daily. All thought this was going to work. Now, what this slide tells us, if you look on the treatment arm, for all three, including tenofovir gel, what those figures tell us is that this showed no effect. It didn't protect against HIV. Now, we were very, you can imagine, we started doing our study. We had to increase the result that showed positive result. Now we get this puzzling result with no effect. But this was part of the problem. They managed to take blood samples throughout the study, and they were able to measure in women in this study's blood whether or not they had taken their tablets and whether or not they had used the gel. And what you can see, and I'll just give you one example, if you look at the top of that table there, in women less than 25 years old, you can see that a quarter or less of women throughout the study could you measure that they had used the product. And so young women were less likely to have used the product, unmarried women were less likely to have used the product, and so on. The problem from this study was not that we don't think these tablets and the gel, but we think they work. But to show they work, we've got to get women in the trial to use them. And that's absolutely critical. And you can see here that if you look at the drug detectable in the blood, what the women, when the same in our studies, the women come in, they return their applicators, they report on what they're doing, and you can see for the tablet and the gel in the yellow, that women report they're using it and they return their applicators. But drug detectable, very little. So we've got a real challenge when we do these studies, that we're going to really push for adherence. Because as Slim said, if you don't use the product in the study, we can't show that anything works. You have to get the women to use the product for us to show that it works. So this is the way that we've gone about this in the FACS trial. We've really thought very long and hard how we persuade women to stay in the trial, to come to the trial, and to use the product. And if we start from the middle, we have the trial participant at the heart of everything. She is the most important person. She's the person that we have to really engage so that she understands and believes in why she's in the study. So the trial sites have comprehensive interventions. There is a community context that the trial sites also look at. And then there are broader issues such as sociocultural trends and the political economy. And I will tell you one thing about that from FACS. To confirm what we all know is that the levels of gender-based violence are significant in our communities. And that's very difficult for us to actually intervene with. So from the FACTS trial, we worked very hard with the participants, with education, to minimize pregnancy by offering contraception and motivational intervention, which I'll explain to you. And this we adapted from the Caprice's experience. From the trial site, we try and make these trial sites very high quality. We offer testing, contraception, we treat sexually transmitted infections. If the women say, I want a lot more product, we give it to them. And very importantly, we've developed a very comprehensive approach to engaging the communities. Because these studies are about communities. They're beyond individual women. It's about what women say to each other in the community, what their partners say, what community leaders say. So each of the trial sites has a community advisory board. We have clubs for the women to join and to share their experiences. And we have what's called good participatory practice that ensures there's proper consultation at a community level. The sites have been extremely innovative in explaining to the women how to use FACT24. It might sound easy once before and once after or within 12 hours, but women do get confused. But even some of the tools that the sites have developed, a paper plate that shows a 24-hour clock, and the women are taught to work out if they put the gel in now, when can they put another gel in? So this is how we pulled all of this together, so that we try and push the women to use the product as much as we possibly can. You've got the applicator there in front of you. So the women are asked to bring back the applicator with them. And we count the applicators, we also inspect them, and I'll show you a picture, because you can actually see if they've been used. They're inspected, they're sniffed, they're looked at. Then the gel use and sexual behavior data is collected by a social scientist. Okay. Then all of that is put together, and the calculation on how well the woman is using the product is done. Then a different counselor talks to the woman, an adherence counselor talks to the woman, and gives her counseling. And the woman directs what she does. So the woman actually, you can see, is battling to use the product as we would like her to. It's not for us to say, use the product, use the product. It won't work. The woman has to say, I understand why I'm battling. I was away from her. I forgot it. My partner didn't say. Let the woman come up with a solution. And this is what we call the adherence. That the woman, with the counselor, works out how she can better use the product. So this is showing you what appears to be used. You can see that on these applicators, you can see those little stripes, marks, which show that what's used, and that we can look at. This is where we got to at the moment. We slowed up enrollment because we were pushing to do it as quickly as possible to the study, but we realized that there was a cost to that. And actually trying to get women to stay in the study and use the product was more important. So we're on target, but we've adjusted our target down, and we've got a slower target. To give you a sense of the characteristics of the woman, though, you can see that about nearly 90% of the women in our study are single, and about 80% are young. So you can see that these women are exactly the women we need to target who are at high risk of HIV, but they're also the women who are less likely to use the product in the study. So we have to work quite hard. This, we track each of the visits. The M at the bottom is the month. Women come back every month, and we track each of the visits for the whole study, and you can see from the red line where the visits are going to, above 80% there. We offer the women contraception so that we try and minimize pregnancy, because women are pregnant, they must stop using product. This is where we've got to now. As I say, we have a board called a Data Safety and Monitoring Board, an independent board of scientists who look over our shoulder. They look at the results. They don't tell us the results on the endpoints, but they can look at them. They looked carefully at this in May of this year, and they told the FACTS team that we should continue with the study. So they looked at safety. They're not concerned that there are any safety issues. They started to look at the outcome of the study, although it's very early. And they said to us that they will look again for a second look in October of this year, and if we're allowed to continue, then that will be the last time this particular committee would probably look. And we're also now starting to take levels of the tenofovir gel from the vaginal fluid, so we will also be able to measure at the end of the study and see whether the women have been using the product. But we're really pushing very hard on the importance of using the product in these studies. This is the whole team of people involved. You can see
with Sapripa, you can see how many organizations, how many scientific organizations in South Africa are now involved at the top, and international organizations who are supporting this effort, including, and I want to stress this, Science and Technology, who've been an incredible supporter all the way. And I want to salute Claudina Lutz, who has really gone the extra mile to support us in this study. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Helen. So you've heard already now about the PAC study, and I think you've got a good sense of where we're going to in terms of research. We want to undertake the bridging process. In other words, thinking from the first, seeing what is it going to take to actually give it to women in a real world setting. And so to explain what the CAPRISA-08 study is and the CAPRISA-09 study is, I'm going to ask Reisha.
Thanks very much, and good morning again to everyone. Helen and Slim have outlined the importance of the science, proof of concept, and confirming the results. At the end of the day, the really important piece in terms of knowledge generation is how we move from the research to public access. And even as the fact of one study is underway, one of the things we can do and hoping to do to enable this process to be fast-tracked. And I'm going to talk about the CAPRISA-08 and CAPRISA-09 trials, and this will be on behalf of both of those teams. I'm very technologically challenged, so I have to remember between the speaker and the pathway, so please bear with me. In his introduction, Slim outlines the product development pathway, and there's some critical steps there. As I highlighted initially, the science of proof of concept and combination, and then the next step would be manufacturing, and we also need normative guidelines. This is an antiretroviral agent. How do you make that available to the public? And then you need to be thinking about how do you implement this. And I'll be talking about CAPRISA-08, which is about integration, and one model looking at how do we do this through family planning clinics, because this is where the majority of women are sexually active and would need to access the product, are likely to do so in the public sector. Then the other part, which is this, a number of, this is not 100% protected product. So what happens when people get infected? And what are the sequence of events in terms of pathogenesis, but also when they need to be on antiretroviral treatment, what are the issues? I mentioned very briefly issues and Helen about resistance. When we measured in CAPRISA-04, we measured resistance in the FAST-001 study in those who get infected. It's over a very short duration. So these studies allow us to look over a longer duration and after people progress to AIDS, what are the implications? And then the preparation for public access. And here we're really looking at marketing issues. We are looking about provider access, user access, and also dovetailing and streamlining efforts with community advocacy efforts. So I'm going to focus on implementation and thank you very much and preparing for public access. And Helen already covered Festival 1. And soon after I'm done, we'll be talking about the manufacturing process as well as the guidelines and where we are there. So from our product development pathway, where we are going. Before I go into CAPRISA-08 and CAPRISA-09, and spend a few minutes building on some of the facts Helen highlighted, the disproportionate burden of HIV infection in young women. And I want to go back to the slide of a population-based study that we undertook in Northern KwaZulu-Natal, PDAC, to the Active Malaria Control Program, way back in 1990. We've had HIV in South Africa from about the early 80s, but it was largely in gay men, and it was also in hemophiliacs prior to our screening or blood and blood products. But in terms of infections in the general population, we really saw this introduction in the late 80s. And this study that was able to sample people across the life course, give us data on men and women, highlighted a couple things. Even in 1990, where the prevalence of HIV infection was less than 1% in the country, in this particular community,
if you follow the blue line and focus on the 15-19-year age group, you can see that there is no infection or very little infection. And so following the blue line, you see by age 20 to 24 in men, you start to see infection. And you see the peak prevalence of around age 25 to 29, and then decline over time. If we now focus on the red line, which is infection in women, and we go to the 10 to 14 year age, you look to see similarly to the young men, there is very little, no infection. However, when you go to age 15 to 90, in women already you post peak prevalence, or already you see women having about 6% HIV infection, and peaking at around age 20 to 24, and then we see, if you just look at the area under the curve, it's also flagging that not only are women getting infected at an earlier age, but they also have more infection compared to men. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to go in the discussion, we can think of why this is so, but this age sex difference is really key to why the epidemic in Southern Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa is as severe as it is. Because if we have these two curves superimposing onto each other, in other words, if you have 15-year-old to 19-year-old young girls having the same amount of infection as 15 to 19-year-old young boys, this epidemic would exhaust itself. But because we've got the 5 to 7 year age difference, and in most communities, sexual coupling patterns, you have this age difference. The difference in Sub-Saharan Africa when we have HIV infection and this age difference, as long as this age difference occurs, we're going to continue to see this epidemic with the severity that we've seen, and it's really critically important not just to prevent infection in young women, because it's important to do that, but it's important to prevent infection in young women to impact our current epidemic trajectory. If we're not able to close the gap with prevention efforts, no matter, we can continue to treat large numbers of people, we can see survival, but we're not going to see the difference in terms of bringing back of this epidemic. So as I said, that data from 1990, all of these here, and Thomas, they've been doing population studies through the HSRC, that pattern continues. So although I've used the old data, we look across Africa. Whether you're looking in Central Africa, Eastern Africa, or West Africa, there is a similar pattern, and this is why Sub-Saharan Africa continues to bear 70% of the burden of infection, and continues to bear the disproportionate burden of new infection, which is estimated to be about 2.5 million from the last surveys that have been done. I'm going to now go back to one of the sites where the PISA-004 trial was done, and where we do annual antenatal surveys that coincide with the national survey. And what you see here is this is really the true face of the epidemic in Sub-Saharan Africa. By age 10, this particular district called Bulanjela is in the Umbulunjogu district. It's one of the three highest burden districts in terms of HIV infection in the world. And by age 16, almost 1 in 10 is already infected with HIV. By age 18, that goes up to 1 in 5. By age 20, we're looking at about 1 in 4 women infected. So this is data from 2009 to 2012. I'm putting more recent data because I want to flag the PISA-004 trial was done, and the results were available in 2010. So this is the situation and the face of the epidemic. This rate of infection by age 24, we're looking at about 44%, so close to 1 in 2 women infected. So when Helen describes her cohort, where the mean age is 23, the mean age of the PISA-004 cohort was also about 23, because as you can see from the data, once you go over 25, many women are already infected. And prior to antiretroviral treatment, we're dying already. So since we're seeing the increased survival in an age group, but the prevention, this is where the heart of the prevention is. We also know that marriage is rare, but cohabiting and stable relationships are very common. Now, when you look at that, you wonder, what are women in these communities doing and what are men in these communities doing? I'm going to hand over to Krishwana to talk
communities are doing in terms of this devastation that that's working its way to these communities.
And I said earlier that I come from the community where this child was done. I needed to make sure that the women understood what the professor was doing. And I found out that they knew their rights. Everything was explained to them nicely. And they knew what they had signed with the informed consent. One of the things that they told me is that they are doing this because in the informed consent, it clearly says if that works, then it's going to be made available to them and to the community, and then it is going to move to the next level until the entire group of women do get other students. So when that did not happen after the news go up in 2010, that Senator Bajel, that Africa was trying, did well, women came to me and said, look what your friends are doing. They said, you're going to ask us, and nothing is happening. And I kept asking them, putting pressure on them. And after the first month, I think it was the 14th month, I then went to do the presentation to the Emergency Control Council because I wanted to answer, were they using our women? Is that what they said in the informed consent? Was it true or not true? And when there were no answers, the women said, we are going to take to the streets. And that's the strategy. They were trying to put pressure on Kapeva. They were putting pressure on Dr. Mosoledi, Minister of Health, putting pressure on our Premier and the Minister of Health in the province. And we named the campaign Siyaifuna, meaning we want it. And since then, our paid effort lady has become our champion. The lady commander is now one of our ambassadors, and we've got about 27,000 women who have signed the petition because we are going ahead until all the women can access it.
Thank you, Dr. Farmer. So what have we done post-having these positive results in all four? So Katrisa OOA is the key goals of it is to provide post-trial access for uninfected participants who complete the Katrisa OOA portrait. This is in accordance with UNAIDS Ethics Guidance Point 19, which says if a trial is successful, you should provide access to the participants as well as communities from which participants come in. So what we've decided is because in discussions with MCC, they said we shouldn't just give the product available because it's unlicensed, it needs to be done under study conditions, we combine the objectives of post-trial access with trying to figure out a model for implementation. So that model that we've developed is really to provide jobs to family plans services, and Anthony mentioned earlier why we chose family plan services, and we introduced the Tanaka Bajel to family plan services on the basis of two things. One is use of a quality improvement model to enhance current family planning services so that we have an expanded mechanism in terms of facility control options, but also in the context of expanding family planning services so that we are doing the HIV testing, in other words, comprehensive sexual reproductive health services, where we're doing survival cancer screening. So it's really been an opportunity as we talk about Tanaka Bajel, as we introduce Tanaka Bajel, how do we also strengthen family planning services and broaden sexual reproductive health services. A third goal of this particular study is to expand and provide additional safety data on Tanaka Bajel. Now, we are currently providing the gel utilizing family planning staff. They either receive the staff, so this is an open label trial where everybody gets Tanaka Bajel. They either get the Tanaka Bajel in the family planning clinic or at the Katrisa clinic. This is a random allocation assigns them to family planning clinic. If they are on the depot or oral contraceptives or other methods, they receive the child every 3 months compared to those who use military where they receive the child every 2 months. Those who come to the Katrisa clinic get the child as we did in the Katrisa oral four child through monthly visits and so on. Now, in preparation for the patient, we have to prepare a whole lot of material for the users, for the providers, and they have put up a very nice display on that end to try and give you some indication of how we
disciplining, what are the manuals we are preparing for the providers, both in terms of provision of knockover gel to support them in terms of the doping strategy, formulation, dispensing, but also the clinical procedures and systems in terms of monitoring safety, doing more intensive pregnancy monitoring for some of the reasons Helen highlighted, and also looking at drug accountability issues. There's also a whole lot of material that can be used during counseling to support adherence, and also key information and how do we collect key information in a clinic setting in terms of monitoring and evaluation, and then what to do if people get infected while they are receiving tenofovir gel through the clinic. So those are all components of the toolkit. At the moment, we have, let's say, Jabhatifana thing. The current status of OA is that we enrolled the first part of the study on the 1st of December. In discussion, we can tell you why did it take from July 2010 to November 1st to enroll the first part of the study. In total, we screened 425 participants in both the urban and rural trials. 359 have been enrolled, and I follow up. 43% of those of women who have enrolled were high adherers in OO4. In other words, our volunteers in OO8 are voting with the feet. Those who were high adherers in OO4 are volunteering to continue to participate. Those who were lower adherers are not coming into OO8. Notably, 54 out of 516 women who were uninfected at the end of Tukisa 004 became infected prior to Tukisa 008. Being initiated, which translates to a 10.5% seroconversion rate with an incidence rate of 3.8 per 100 women. So as we wait and as we continue the top tips and the diseases, I'm going to shift now from Tukisa 008 to Tukisa 009. This is a reminder, this is a follow-on on HIV-infected participants. So there's a TISA 04 trial. We're going to monitor disease prevention, therapeutic outcomes, and drug resistance. The population is 119 seroconverted, and also those 54 individuals who we've identified as infected, and as we continue with 08 in new infections that come through. All of the seroconverted are in follow-up with care when they're eligible. They initiated on a tenofovir-containing regimen and a non-tenofovir-containing regimen. And at the moment, we have about 34 people already on antiretroviral treatment, and 15 of them from the tenofovir gel arm. We now have a therapeutic success rate currently of close to 90%. So the disease OOH in summary provides an opportunity to generate evidence for implementation. And this is going to be needed when we need a licensed product. We think it's going to be critical to have research naive volunteers to give us the full profile. At this point in time, the NCC has not allowed us to do that. Capisa 09 will provide additional safety data post-infection following exposure to the tenofovir and address some of the concerns clinicians have about drug resistance and therapeutic options following strep exposure. The toolkit based on our experience will enable us to rapidly introduce and scale up a licensed product. And I just want to underscore that while tenofovir gel potentially as a new approach to empower women to take control of their risk of infection, and the Capisa 004 study provided the first step, it's likely, as we do with all medical advances, that over time other formulations and products may have tenofovir gel, but that the trial access provides us to narrow the gap between proof of concept, the science, and public assets. And there's a number of people that we'd like to acknowledge, and I won't go into the details, but a number of funders, again, Laudina through the DST and the Department of Science and Technology, quite extensive child oversight team in the US and locally, and support from a number of other institutions. And I'd like to stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. So in my last 2 or 3 minutes, just to say that the next step within South Africa has been to look at how do we manufacture and make this available. We were very fortunate in 2004 when I went to visit Gilead Sciences to get tenofovir from them to make the gel. I asked the board of Gilead Sciences show that it's worked and then they make money out of it. We want to own the product. That company never give you their product, that's how they live. But we are very fortunate that in this instance, Gilead Sciences, even before we knew this, started negotiating with us to give us the license for Tanaka Gel. So right now, within West Africa, we own the rights to Tanaka Gel, which is royalty free. In other words, we give no money to Gilead at all. This is Gilead's contribution to trying to stem the HIV epidemic. So they will get no money out of this at all. They have undertaken to provide free tenofovir to the first batches of all the research that we need. So we get tenofovir for free. In the future, we need to be able to make tenofovir gel. And right now, when we make tenofovir gel, we make it in the US, in a very specific company that knows how to do this. We've had a team of South African technicians go there to visit DDT laboratories to learn how to do this. And we are now in the process of setting that up here. But before we do that, we have very detailed investigations that need to be done. And so a new entity called Pro7. Pro7 is a public-private partnership. It brings together the Technology Innovation Agency, or DST. It brings together the IDC. It brings together Cipla Metro, a private drug company in South Africa. These three have come together with a company, an organization in the U.S. that has a lot of this technology called Conrad, which is an NGO. But these four together have created Pro7, and they are now investigating the feasibility of actually establishing a factory. They have two sites in mind that have already been investigated. They have preliminary designs of the factory that they are looking at. They're looking at what the costs are going to be to actually establish the equipment and the manufacturing to make it. And once we get the go-ahead from the Medicines Control Council after the results of the fact that, then all of this will then keep into place, and we will be able to ensure that we are able to make and have the capacity to make tonsil gel. I want to just end off by saying that it's quite important to recognize that this has really been an amazing national effort. We have brought together scientists from across the country who have all come on board to undertake this research to try and get us to a point where we would empower women with something that they can use to prevent HIV infection. But more than that, it's also been an international effort. All of this research has been co-funded by the US government and our government. Together, we have been undertaking this research. And as we look to how we're going to move this forward, DSC has provided us with the important leadership that's needed, and that Minister Anupam has personally himself even been volunteered to meet the women to look at how it's available. We've had obstacles. One needs to know that. The main obstacles we've had revolve around our regulator, the Medicines Control Council. It took them 2 years to get approval to make the gel available in the computer. That is really unacceptable. And you heard how between the Computer 004 study and the 008 study, because we didn't have gel available to these women, 54 women became infected. We could have prevented several of those 54 women from getting HIV infection. We're being delayed in trying to move this process forward. But we, now that we have our approval, we are taking that initiative and we're trying to do what we can to prepare it possible. It just remains for me to thank DST for their vision, for their support, their foresight, to thank all the researchers that have been involved, and mostly to thank the thousands of women who have come diligently to the clinic every month, who participated in the study, and who have really made this possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll allow Honorable Smith there,
Honorable Drew, your second, in that order. Thanks, Jim. And my congratulations to the whole team. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful initiative that you've launched. And I think we're all very excited by the outcomes. Yeah, I have a string of questions. I was part of the team that led you back into the world in the first place. So I was very interested to watch the progress. And may I say, you've always been very slow progress in some respects, the obstacles. But just very quickly, I'll run through a few questions. I'm not sure, when we last met, the issue then going forward was about funding for Caprice Cabaret. The issue was that the U.S. was putting out funds, but we were really backing the FA side of the bargain. And that obviously resolved itself in time. But has it, from our side at least, been smooth sailing since then on the funding side? Or does that constitute a real hiccup? Second question is, there was one slide you showed earlier, I think it was some African thing, where you were looking at the tablet and the gel. And I'm just trying to work out in my head what they might, you know, are they meant to achieve the same thing, or are they targeting something different? And then is there, are there any social issues related to the acceptance of one form of vacation as opposed to the other, which would make one more efficacious perhaps in a mass rollout? Then you also go, the Caprice government of course spoke about a 39% expense rate or something. You spoke earlier about up to 90 depending on certain circumstances. One of the slides said 80-odd%. So my question there really is, you know, what is it that, what percentage are we looking at if you were to roll this out as an ASP program? What kind of efficacy rate are you looking at, percentage-wise? Between those, I presume 39 would be a pretty low figure, 1995 would be really high. What would you kind of expect to achieve? Then, how long is this going to take before it's rolled out? Yeah, because the issue back even then, several years ago, was get it out as fast as possible. You've got a 2-year delay from the MCC, but even this fact, the 001, doesn't say you know, what the conclusion is. Isn't it another year, 2 years, 3 years? How long? Then you still got to get, you know, the next step. A silly question, really. Do you know why it's not 100% effective? If you say that it targets the CD4 receptor cells and by protection, it obviously doesn't do several cases. Why not? A couple of years ago when we were with you, I thought that if the, you know, after you finished 004, that 008 was meant to be the confirmatory study. Not, the confirmatory study wasn't that. I thought this would be moving to straight away, and 008 was going to be that. And now I think 008 is a different thing altogether. Did I just even kind of say at the time, did it change its focus as time progressed? On the IP of the actual clinical constituents or whatever, the company is Gilead, or I can't remember the company, said, I presume they still own the IP, even though they give us unlimited access to it. So it's not like we own the IP now. They can still do with it what they will elsewhere, but we have unlimited access. Yeah, okay. That's good enough. No, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes,
you
you are not talking to official institutions. The young women, why? Because they are there. I don't know, out on the side, because there are official institutions in the case of any sort. I'm raising this because it's where also the challenge is, which I don't think that if they are again, in the community, it's always my biggest challenge. I really believe in community participation. Some of the scientific and projects and research that I become more excited when the ordinary people are made to understand. For them, so that they understand that in fact this is not. Remember, science has always been perceived as always been about people that have got money, made. So when we say enrich, and when research of nature as human beings, because that's what made me to be excited about our own research, is a research proves that the project that is in the different areas. And for me, that really makes me very excited and committed for that. But the last question is called, why I wanted to ask, why in the, are you envisaging going into or looking location within the urban area? I'm raising that because when I'm looking into the land, there are problems as well as the zone here. And I was looking into this chair suddenly, and then I was supposed to look into this one. This on the attention and I see that. Now I ask myself, it was two cities in this one, Northern Cape is in the boundary of the Botswana. And there's nothing like in the Western Cape. And why this tree, when do you think you are then going to go out? The last time the research here in this plant, which is like an unfortunate, there is no indication of what is the facility in terms of Angola and Namibia. And I'm a bit uncomfortable that or find strange that you are not reflecting those projects you perceive.
Remember, I reminded that we're about to half past 11 to wind up. Please remember that the leaders still have got to respond to you, and then you must not mind now when you are going to stay here at 2 o'clock and start harassing me. Okay.
I will leave certain questions. I don't have a background that the other members have, because I was not part of the previous oversight visit. But I would like to ask, you started off with they participate in the study, but they don't use the product. Doesn't make sense to me. What kind of orientation do you need women get initially? Because it doesn't make sense to me that they are part of the study and they don't make use of the product. I think I will not continue with all the other questions, seeing that we have a problem.
I'm talking of the fact that this gem is empowering you. What I'd like to find out are two issues. One, because I saw that it's women who got infected when on trial. They didn't get that. Is it still in time? Or can then the infection, those who are already infected, use it for maybe prevention of further infection? And as I said, it's aimed at empowering women. But then, how do men benefit from this?
I think Prof is again.
Thank you very much. You've asked many excellent questions.
gives you about 10,000 times higher level of drug than the tablet does in the vagina. So the tablet is already down your whole body, the gel keeps the drug in the vagina compartment. And we are mainly interested in preventing resistance, and therefore we've gone with the gel option. Both, however, have been shown to be effective. So it's not like the lower doses will not be effective. It is just that the compartmentalization is what we're trying to achieve, that we don't get systemic drugs. The third issue around effectiveness, what is true effectiveness? You can't tell true effectiveness in many of these studies, because to tell true effectiveness, you have to make sure that the person uses the drug every time. And that's something you can't establish. And so the way in which we do that is we try to approximate that based on the level of drug that's present in the vagina or in the body. If we just take those people who have drug presence in the vagina or in the blood, and you analyze that, you get between 90 and 93% efficacy, whether you use tablets or the gel. And the gel study shows 90.5% efficacy if you analyze it that way. That analysis is not the standard analysis we use, because it only takes into account a case-controlled analysis of those using drugs. It doesn't take the control of the placebo arm, because it's trying to measure drug in the placebo arm. But it's a legitimate analysis, and we do provide it to the regulators. But the way in which we convey the message to you, what would you expect in the real world? We would expect somewhere around 39, 40, 50%. We would not expect 90%, because people won't use it. But in terms of why not 100%? That's a very good question. So that's where we are now spending large amounts of our time in the laboratory. We have set up in the laboratory models and test tubes to mimic vagina. So what we do is we get tissue in women who are having a hysterectomy. They give us permission to use their tissue. We take the tissue, we throw it in the test tube. We recreate a vagina in the test tube, and then we're testing why is it sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. We have now identified probably the single most important reason why it doesn't work. And I can assure you I will be here to come tell you those results when it's ready. The paper is currently. In short, to give you a sneak preview, we have established that in some women, they have a unique signature in their vagina that shows that they have inflammation. That this inflammation attracts TD4 cells, these target cells. And those target cells that are being attracted don't yet have drugs. And so those are the ones that are able to get infected. So we're now trying to understand what's calling those cells, why are they coming, what's creating the inflammation. There's a whole lot of research. We are now also making a new gel that has an anti-inflammatory together with the chocolate. So you see, there's a lot of research here. The first drug that was used to treat diabetes is never 100%. You have to work your way towards it. That's what we're doing now. In terms of confirmatory studies, it was always designed for post-trial access. We have an ethical obligation to these women. We knew that upfront. We raised that with the ethics. We have an ethical obligation. These women contributed the knowledge. We owe it to them to give them gel. And so Patricia always designed. Nobody gets the people. Everybody gets the gel. We asked the NPC to allow us to extend it to other populations. Allow us to extend it to those locations we talked about. Allow us to extend it to the Eastern Cape. Because let us start by just giving it to everybody in the lower district, which we know is the worst affected district in the country, and they have done. So we are only allowed to give the gel now to women who are originally part of the FISA-04 study. But we are planning now for faculty to get approval to extend it to address your question directly. I want to address the issue of IV. IV is the actual formulation for tenofovir, the actual basically owned by Eric Westerplan. Eric is an investigator from Belgium, and he sold the rights to this to Gilead. So they have the rights to it. He is the original inventor. He still gets a little bit of money for every tablet of tenofovir that's sold. He's a great
gel in preventing herpes infection, that is our intellectual property. We own the patent. So that belongs to us, and we will be able to exploit that at some point. And our goal is to make that in the public domain on a non-profit basis, rather than to try and make money out of it. I'm going to ask Leila to explain to you about why there's no expiry date. It's because we don't understand this, and we don't know it depends in the container that has the expiry date. And it also explains to them all of the conditions around how they should store it. Can you just say a few words about that?
I think that the claim is public. You know, when we dispense the box, we put on a label with the participant name and the expiry date and that sort of thing. It's all on there.
In terms of, we've not seen anybody develop any sensitivity to chocolate vegetable yet. We have seen some latex sensitivity. Latex is used in the condom. The problem we normally deal with, we have ways of dealing with it, but we have not yet seen sensitivity. In terms of tertiary university women, unfortunately, our clinics have to be on the basis that we can study women for up to 2.5 to 3 years. Remember, the tertiary for study was 3 years. So that university women are not a good idea because they move on. So that's what we haven't done them in the first batch. But our plan is to do them because they are very high risk groups that could really benefit from it. They are powered and will be able to use it if we make it available. And in terms of the data on Angola and Libya, we have restricted data from the UNAIDS book where we made that slide. So at the bottom we say source UNAIDS and we give you the title of the book. So we only have the data from the countries that are in the UNAIDS book. So unfortunately UNAIDS didn't have that data, that's why it's not that data. I want to end up with the issue of what does it mean to participate in the study and don't choose products. I'm going to ask Professor Gray to address that issue because it's one that we grapple with, whether it's a treatment study, whether it's a vaccine study. I mean, why do we have a drug-resistant TB problem? You don't take it for 6 months. You only have to take it for 6 months and then not eat. So we grapple with this every day of our life.
It's a good question, and as John said, we do grapple with it all the time about people. We, you know, we have participants who benefit greatly from being enrolled into trial. They get regular HIV testing, they get access to condoms, they get access to vaginoplasty, and they get access to health education. And so it's a huge benefit to the woman to enroll into the study. We find a correlation between perception of risk and product use. So women who perceive themselves to be at risk for HIV are much more likely to use the product than women who don't. And so there's the issue of maybe being in denial, issues about, Helen spoke about intimate partner violence. And so some women may have the desire to take the product, but when they get home and they're in a difficult relationship with their partner, they may not have the freedom to use it freely. In terms of other reasons, they may go out and they may not realize that they're going to have sex and their products at home and they fell off. So there are lots of reasons, and we work very closely with women to try and anticipate these issues. And so if you are going to go out, you know, put a drop of gel in your handbag. If you do think your partner will hurt you, take the gel long before you have sex. So just to get women to plan, women lead chaotic lives, all of us lead chaotic lives. Look at my all the paper here. We know we have chaotic lives and sometimes we can't plan our lives. And so we try and counsel women to manage their lives and the gel at the same time. And also to explain about sensitivity to HIV and to understand risk. And so it's an ongoing thing, and it's all of us, you know, who finishes their antibiotics? You know, I don't, and I'm a doctor. who remembers to take the antihypertensive? So do you take it this morning? So it's about how, as we, human nature. It's about learning to understand your risks and why you take medication. It's an ongoing struggle for all of us, including doctors who manage, who even prescribe medicine. So it's a social behavioral issue that we continue to challenge all of us in all disciplines.
Thank you very much. I want to ask Dr. Ngadi to just comment very briefly on her. So she's the doctor in the clinic dealing with these women. And one of the challenges we've experienced in asking women to use a tablet every day or use a gel every day, particularly just think about, you know, having to insert a gel every day and not have effects. That was one of the challenges we had in this particular study, that you get told women didn't use it.
capacity department.
Yeah. I've had the pleasure of working both in Horse Child, like we mentioned here, and then working on Crete and Georgia. And I can confirm what you were saying, that at the beginning of the Horse Child, women on the eastern of the jail complained about the business. And in fact, it was part of the study procedure for us to give them sanitary wear and to advise them how to use it. And I can only imagine, if I look at the two trials, one where you're using it around the quilts related to sex, and one where you have to use it every day, that there's going to be a considerable build-up in women who are using it every day, and for making them less likely to use it because they feel uncomfortable. They have to go about their life still and try and incorporate this gel into it. But also in terms of the risks that you spoke about, part of the education in a trial is to explain to people about what is just behavior. So women learn that the risk is around the sexual act. And asking them then to take product every day when they're not having sex every day doesn't make sense to anybody unless we the social behavioral and human nature aspects of it comes in. In that an ordinary person who can't even logic in what you're asking them to do is less likely to follow the instruction.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm going to answer your last two questions very quickly. The first issue is, what about women who became infected during these trials? So in those women, they are not allowed to use tenofovir. Because if you already have the virus, it has no benefit for you. You cannot prevent somebody if you already got the virus. In those women, what we have done is that we have enrolled them into the Katrisa 09 study. And the reason to do that is we want to see, did the use of tenofovir impact on our ability to treat them with tenofovir, because remember we use tenofovir in treatment and in first-line regimen. So what we're doing is all of these women who became infected, we take and randomize. One arm, they get a tenofovir containing antiretroviral combination, the other arm gets a tenofovir sparing combination. There's no tenofovir there. We go with either T or the other. So what we're trying to see, is there any problem with using tenofovir in patients in women who became infected while using tenofovir gel? And so far, our study shows no problem at all. So that's the study that's being done, and we have to do this over a long time. So the women who are infected no longer get the gel. I want to answer the last question then, which is how long? We should have had a small goal. But you know, as the African proverb says, you know, you'd like to have planted the cheek 20 years ago. We didn't do it there. So please plant it now. The World Health Organization has held two consultations, international consultations, and they brought all the world's leading players together. And out of one of those consultations came the Green Book, and I have a few copies of the Green Book available. This book is a World Health Organization report. It's called Next Step for 1% Chance of the Gel. It spells out what needs to be done to roll it out. And there are several pieces in this puzzle. Key in all of this is the international guidelines. The World Health Organization has already prepared a set of guidelines. It's a draft guidelines which they have sent out for comment. So they are anticipating all of the things that the rest of the things that we have to do will be done by the time they have made their guidelines available. So you can see it's a long time frame. If you were to ask me if the FACT study is effective, when will we have it? So I'm going to ask Professor Lee to comment about what the timeline for the tax study and then I'll tell you more what the end game will be.
So we're anticipating that we would have results in 2014. We will then look for, I think that it would be reasonable and that would be obviously we would then look at the results together because we have the Caprice 04 and the tax results. I think we would then definitely ask the Medical Control Council to do a fast track approval. The Medical Control Council is enabled to do a fast track approval for a new product where there's no other product market and also where something is potentially licensed. So I think that I'm hoping that we won't see this then today. And I think just alerting everyone to that there's now a very serious initiative for the Department of Health to overhaul the FTC. Thank you. hopefully some of these real backlog that has historically occurred will not occur in the future. If that's the case, I'm saying you can put your figure to this, but we were thinking Glenda and I would have to look at this. We'll probably be 2017 or something like that before we have the part. Just one last thing on question of why don't women use it. You just must remember that taking things for prevention is, in all our lives, much more difficult than taking things when we're sick. And that when the women join the study, remember what we're telling them. We're telling them, we don't feel like this will work on us, and you might be on a placebo. So we're not telling them, you're definitely going to have a product that will be 50% effective. We're saying, you're in a study. So it's a different kind of motivation to the woman. We say to her, here's the product, it's 50% effective, you can go into your family planning clinic and give it. We would then hope the women that volunteer to do that are motivated to use it. It's a very different scenario between a trial.
And so it's just amazing for me to say that I think if we were optimistic, we would say we're looking at the 2016 launch of product. I would say the more realistic, probably late 2016, early 2017. So drug development is a long road, and it's a long road to get from the time we show proof of concept, which was 2010, in June, to the time we actually have a product available in pharmacy in the shelves. Sitting at 7 years long. I want to just end, we think we've answered all of the questions. I want to just take this opportunity to pay tribute to two women who really are the reason we are even here having this discussion. The one is Greta, who was the leader of the study, the principal investigator who led this initiative right from the start, and to Gedwan, who represents that community. They are really the force behind this. They were the ones that kept coming to us and talking to us, well, what is it we're going to do to help them prevent HIV infection? So I want to pay tribute to Ifana and the women from all of the studies who have participated in my COVID study, particularly the PHO4 and the FACT study. It is really on their shoulders that we have been able to achieve this much. Thank you.
Can you just
ask
for your permission? I was wondering, such a treatment program not effective, what was the problem, how was it corrected?
This was what was that, I'm having to pick up the answer.
It's the voice study.
Well, the voice study. The voice study was the study where they asked the women to take the tablet or the gel every day. And the problem that they realized after the study had been completed was that the women hadn't taken it, or a very small proportion of the women had. And now we understand the problems of doing that. Essentially, we ask people to do something that is very hard to do. And so if it was not practical, they were not able to do it. In our experience, if you ask women to put the gel in at the time of sex, when they're going to have sex, we tend to get much higher adherence. So we are able to get the women. Women are able to use the funds much more so when they have to insert it at the time of sex. So that's the difference between the two.
They accept those documentary ends?
Yeah, so this is presented at the CROI meeting. We've got debated extensively. We've also shared it with the regulators. And this is widely accepted as the reason for the difference.
And in fact, the women themselves have now been spoken to in that study by social scientists to say, well, what happened here? And women said, no, we didn't take it. And my friend said, I could still come to the clinic and get all this nice treatment and get some money, but I don't have to take it. And quite a lot of women have actually now they've understood, have actually acknowledged responsibility and are beginning to say, we feel bad. We didn't really understand that it was going to, you know, just be cause such damage. To a big extent. So I think that this is something else that we're learning from as we talk to women now enrolled in the study.
Thank you very much for a very, very comprehensive and informative presentation. I think that you deserve some applause for the committee. Very good. Usually we can't do that, but this is a good night.
Right, the anonymous person, the AISA presentation, who are responsible for AISA? You start with AISA and end up with another.
Before we proceed with the presentation, just a question for clarity. When we had our last meeting, we raised a number of matters. I'm not sure whether those issues we raised resulted in any amendments or not. If there were any amendments, we haven't had them yet. At least I haven't had them, so I don't know if there are any.
Now we'll
start again.
We'll clarify
that
ministry, myself, and the entities, and think that all what were hiccups in terms of incorporation and application between the two entities is now that has been sorted out. And sorry, now. Probably what we can say, what we can do before we start our presentation, which may clarify a number of other questions that were raised before. We would allow the two entities to brief us about the smoothing out of the process that they've undergone during the consultation that I've just mentioned. I don't know between them who would like to start a review committee about where things are now in terms of incorporation, probably. HSRC as the body which the transfer is going to, and then after that, and we listen also to AISA's expression of this aspect. And then there were some matters last time that were raised by the committee for clarification, and those matters they are not covered by the declarations from the both the entities, and we will ask the department to clarify us. HFRC, can you just brief us about how it has been smoothed out after the consultation with both the office and that of the minister?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, President, Honorable Member. We met with the Minister of Science and Technology together with the two chefs of the two boards, as well as the CEOs of the two organizations, and Director General, as well as the number 10 to the DDG in the Science and Technology. We had a discussion about...
I think we must add that she is also being delegated to oversee the whole transition, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yes, we met, and when we met with the minister, there was a clear need to have someone full-time delegated to ensure that this transition moves as quickly as possible, and it moves as smoothly as possible. And as indicated, Mr. Kwena was appointed to do that. She obviously will not be 100%, but she will really be a dedicated person to do that work. In addition to that, we had a discussion regarding the question of the AISA brand, and the agreement basically was that in the act itself, it will not prescribe as to what should happen to the brand of AISA, because you cannot repeal an act and still include in that appeal the existence of the same entity that you say it should not be. So it will have to be dealt with outside of the legislation. And then the issue of cooperation between the two entities, it became clear that there was an interest from the part of AISA and of the HSRC to proceed with the incorporation and address some of the challenges that we have, like with regard to staff. Some of the staff are concerned that what has happened after incorporation if it with all incorporations, there are always varieties that are generated, and we indicated very clearly that the Labor Relations Act would actually apply to this incorporation. So there won't be anything that's done outside of the law in terms of incorporation. And that was addressed. And then there was also the issue of possible other people that might be lobbying on behalf of ISA to actually recommend that ISA should not be incorporated. They were not representing ISA as far as we understand from the board itself, as well as management itself. We did not get the impression that the board or management was actually part and parcel of that exercise. It was really, they were prepared, you know, to move. My understanding from the meeting is that they wanted this issue to be resolved speedily in order to be able to calm the situation with regard to the staff so that there is certainty in terms of what is actually going to happen. They want to recognition of the fact that there are some areas of strength of ISA that would you know, benefit from being incorporated into the HSRC. And there are areas where, you know, some weaknesses would have also have to be addressed. So we have to look at it very comprehensively. We also had a discussion about the importance of incorporation in terms of reducing the administrative cost that is currently, you know, being experienced by ISA budgets. Much of it ends up being, or half of it ends up being for administration. So if it enters into the HSRC, a lot of that administration will be done by the HSRC, meaning that, you know, we'll be able to save some money. And finally, I just want to say that in terms of the research, the teams have been meeting, and they've been meeting under the inter-management committee, that the incorporation management committee, that includes ISA, HSRC, and DST. And that committee has been working hard to make sure that all those things that need to be addressed are attended to. Because our understanding is that once if the bill is passed and it goes into law, it will be necessary to ensure that all the assets of ISA are actually safeguarded so that there are no problems with regard to Auditor General in terms of management assets. I'm not sure if the chair would like to add anything.
Chairperson and honourable members, the CEO, Dr. Shasana, has actually covered a lot of it. But just to say on the side of the board, we're very encouraged by the outcome of the meeting between the chair of ISA and the acting CEO, myself, and the CEO of HSRC on our side. After that meeting, there was an acknowledgement that actually a lot of work has been done and is underway. Moving towards incorporation, what we have committed on both sides of the board to acknowledge the fact that at the end of the day, this is about human beings and making sure that as we progress, that there is no feeling of senior partner, junior partner kind of an arrangement. Both boards have undertaken to make sure that nothing of the sort is perceived. But most importantly, this we see this as an important national project rather than a project that is about two entities in the sense that there's an overarching objective to making sure that where in any portfolio there are a number of operations, we all take responsibility of making sure that if a benefit of having those working closer or being in incorporating one order to make a minimal impact, that is done. But most importantly, the commitment of the country in making sure that Africa as a continent succeeds lies in ensuring that this project of incorporation succeeds and that nothing in terms of the strategic important work that is being done by either ISA or HSRC is actually in jeopardy. That instead it is strengthened. So we believe that out of that really we've consolidated findings, but also we've committed in making sure that the stakeholders on both sides, when there are issues of perception or real discomfort, those issues to be resolved within the structures that have been made available
rather than seeking advice outside. It was for that reason that DNT undertook to make sure that the DG that is responsible for supporting the IMC is given much more dedicated time to ensure that those assets are available. So we are moving one, and Dr. Rajaya couldn't make it today because of prior engagements, but he's giving also his support to take the field campuses. We're moving as one, and that the legislative framework will go a long way once it's finalized to just make sure that everything is moved quicker to finality.
No, thank you, Dr. Chisano and the chair of the we just want to check if it's any addition from Anita.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, and good morning, members of honourable members of Parliament. The Minister of Science and Technology, Dr. Hannah Koma, was able to meet with the AYUSA board on the 10th of May, and he explained in a much more clearer way why this action was being taken. And even the members of the board that had initially were not happy about the move were at the end of the meeting finally agreed that they understand why the Department of Science and Technology decided to incorporate AYUSA into HSRC. He was able to allow the members of the board of AYUSA to express themselves, explain and ask questions and, you know, bring out their concerns and frustrations, but at the end of the meeting, everybody felt, well, this was a move that is for the good of the nation as well as the continent, seeing that the reasons were now understood by the members of the AYUSA board. And that meeting took place before the meeting we had with the HSRC and the minister last week, Friday. I think the rest has been explained by HSRC. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Member.
I'm sorry, I missed it before I addressed the HSRC. Just a minute. Right, are there any issues of clarity from the committee?
To the fact that I wasn't here during the previous meeting, I had to undergo emergency surgery. I was in hospital. You referred to the explanation given by the minister to the two boards. Did the committee give the same explanation? Did the DG, his presentation during the previous meeting, was that exactly the same? Do you have the same information? And I pick up in the document that Dr. Osborne Mullins sent to us that the receivable does not make a reason for the incorporation. Can we get some clarity on that? And as I said in my budget speech, I got the impression that the whole process of incorporation has already started, long before we started dealing with the bill. So exactly what's going on here? Is this only a rubber stamp? Aren't we supposed to deal with the bill first before incorporation starts at all? I'm just not sure why that is going on.
We also suspended any proceedings yet because the minister wanted us to have the end court of them and have clarity on issues of concern, which understandably happened, and that's why we also invited him to be here. But after the minister also wrote a letter to me after he had a consultation with them, in which he said that he must also consult with me on behalf of the committee and what the
Monday afternoon. And that is why I invited them to come here, so that any other questions of clarity, they should clarify them before you come here. But the most standard block, as you remember, they waived some contact from letters that we had received as a committee from some people that were saying that the incorporation shouldn't go ahead. But then it was clarified in that conversation that actually those people were lobbyists for some board members because they were not sure of their future. So otherwise those, because I think anything about two letters from people who are associated with certain eyes who felt that incorporation shouldn't go ahead, Parliament was obstructed. So, but after the consultation with the minister and consequently with me, we understood, the court understood it, and those letters were actually in the exam shop inside the throne office of the people inside, which means that that's not a, therefore, of a big challenge that we expected. Honorable Smith?
Chair, my question. I presume we're going to get to the substance of all this now, but just on this exposure.
Yeah.
I think we feel reassured. But clearly, the messages we were getting before were very problematic. I mean, even the simplest statement, as I used to say, we have not been consulted. The minister comes along and says, well, we met at the airport. Or whatever. You know, I mean, you can't have contradictory statements like that. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, everybody now has agreed they're all on the same wave. That's very useful. So I'm quite happy that we've got that stage. And now it's just a technical issue. It's no longer a physical issue.
I think we are. I just want to make the every voice on the leadership that is provided, and that is the perspective. Well, Chair, I'm saying that I just want to echo the leadership that is provided are good and clean. And hope that, and I think I'm confident that the moving forward is going to be a unity in action, not for the people of either, whoever, but for the benefit of the country. And I think that is very important. And lastly, that it has been said here, but I think that we will be able to do that outside of the election. I think for me, it gives me a level of comfort that it won't be anything said as this whole process is unfolding. I don't think it will be.
Yeah, I think what we now need to go through, well, there were some concerns that have been expressed by the committee before, and if they fall outside what you have just discussed, can the department and body institution probably clarify us, but I think particularly the department, because it was the department that's telling you to remember things that were concerned, especially like the reference of the funding as ISA goes into education. Anybody who can contribute to the queries of the committee before, and whether it's state law advisors, I remember there were some questions that were directed to state law advisors, so along that advice.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'm already dealing with the recent things. I think the concern was what has been done in civil security. We have a recent confirmation from Treasury that the consultation may be in a very detailed process since the means of funding is commenced and the approved and certificated.
You must also circulate that copy of the letter to the committee secretariat for members' distribution.
Okay, thank you.
What else members to concentrate? Okay. Let's start here first. Yeah. So you.
Thanks.
Okay. There were some comments that were raised by the members of the committee on the seal of the provisions of the bill itself. And some comments also on the provisions of the bill were raised by the parliamentary law advisor. We gave responses to most of the comments that were raised by the committee and the federal advisor. But there were some few questions that we had to go back and reconsider. And we met with, we had a meeting with the parliamentary law advisor and the state law advisor to put our heads together to, you know, come up with responses.
That's what we need. It just was straight to the point because we have already run out of time.
Chair, we have circulated the proposed amendment to the bill, which we hope that the committee can adopt, which we believe addresses the questions required changes to be effected on the bill. Firstly, we have in clause 3, on page 3 from line 5, we're proposing that the way this established and dissolves be deleted and be substituted with hereby dissolved. The question was we inconsistent in that in relation to the content the provision read the content hereby disestablished, but in relation to the institute, the agency, but in relation to the council, which is the board of the agency, the provision stated is established and dissolved, and the correct way in discussions with the stakeholders and followers to delete the word disestablished, which merely says now the council will be dissolved, but the institute, which is the agency, will be established. And also inconsistency in the wording, because in this clause we're saying with effect from the date contemplated in section 5, which means with effect from the date of commencement. But in clause 2 relating to the institute, we're saying it's hereby dissolved. So we agree that just to be consistent in relation to the language used, we will also change to hereby dissolve, meaning we effect from the commencement of the act. So it is consistent in terms of the language used now in relation to what happens to the council and what happens to the institute. The second amendment relates to also on page 3. Clause 3.6, which we are proposing to delete in its entirety and replace with a new clause 6. The issue was it refers to the institute's operational activities, which was problematic in a sense that the institute would have been established, so you can't really then refer to its operations as if it is continuing as it is. So we had to build in a deeming clause in redrafting it to say notwithstanding the repeal of the Upper Institute of South Africa by Section 4, which the board does, the Institute and organization for a period of 3 years from date of consultation should exclusively reserved for those activities performed within the cartage who have been performed by the former institute. So we are recognizing that the institute has been devolved, but we're saying not stating that its parliamentary local allocation will be reserved within the institute for the function that were performed by it or would be performed within the cartage, so to avoid the situation of referring to as if it continues as it is, despite the repeal. Chair, those are the changes that we propose to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair, thank you, and thanks for the presentation. I'm happy with the first clause. It makes perfect sense, consistency of language. But the second clause, I have a lot of problems with it, and I'm not sure that I'm reading it the same way my colleagues across there are reading it. So perhaps I should just spell out my concern. First is just a grammatical issue or semantic issue. I'm not sure what the second line by section 4 refers to. To me, it's utterly meaningless, and I'd like to know what it's intended to achieve. Second concern is that although we've addressed the issue of the previous wording, which included the existence of, in that clause, of an institution that has been established, so you now left the opposite issue, that there's nothing there which ensures that the brand continues. But I suppose we would be asked to accept that this is now a political decision that would be implemented. So it doesn't have its place in the bill, or maybe it's in your bill, your act, but it's not here. I can live with that. But the argument that says because the institution was being, the old clause included it there, and it's been disestablished, so you bring the attention right for it, so it's inconsistent. The same logic still applies here in a sense, because in terms of new wording, you're affecting Parliament the way I see it. You're constraining Parliament for the next 3 years to be voting on an annual budget vote that we pass in the House. You're telling us that we must appropriate funds for an institute that doesn't exist. And those funds would go to another institution that does exist in order that previously established thing can have its activities ring-fenced. I can't see how you can do that. I just don't know. I mean, Parliament, you can't constrain Parliament now and tell us for the next 3 years you must do this in terms of the budget. At least I don't think you can. Maybe you can. But that's the question there. And then my third concern was Dr. Chitrana made a point. It's one of the rationales for the merger that half of the IEPA budget goes on administration, and that by merging, the administration costs would be borne by the HSRC, so there would be cost saving. Okay. So in terms of this wording, it institutes parliamentary allocation at the total. It's not one reserved for research. It's the total budget allocation now goes to this non-existing entity inside the HSRC. But half of its budget is being covered by the HSRC, not by itself, because half of its admin savings. So effectively, it's getting double the budget it needs, because the money you should be ring-fencing is the one for the operational research outcomes, not for admin, which is already covered by somebody else. So I think that has also been problematic. So, you know, so I do have a few concerns with the wording there.
With the state of letters, probably Sebastian, that Alan.
I'm trying to, especially with regards to the first one. The first question is that the words by section 4 are clear, doesn't make sense. The clause, both clause starts with notwithstanding the repeal of the African Institutes Act 2001 by section 4, and if you look at the bill, to bind Parliament, but I don't see anything which is unconstitutional in the matter, which is untoward. Of course, it's Parliament's decision whether to adopt the clause as it is.
Can I just clarify my understanding then? My understanding is that this is the money already allocated in the MDF cycle of 3 years, and by this incorporation, there will be some save of the money which would have gone to administration, which, because money is already there, is not going to be appropriated afresh from Parliament. It will be redirected to research, which is mainly what the IASH is supposed to perform, as far as I understand. The honourable member wants to have a follow-up question.
Chair, just on the issue of the budget, not the admin's cost, the way I understand it is we only appropriate fund annually for an annual budget. What we have is NDEF, which are indicative allocations. They're only indicative, but we don't approve them per se. Parliament simply gets an indication from the executive that this is the funds we need, executive are prepared to make available, but we're only asked to vote on the annual appropriation. Next year, the indicative allocation becomes an annual as it's adjusted. So in fact, this is still telling, so we actually have an annual budget carry. So this is saying, basically the way I read it, this is saying Parliament is going to approve something for the next 3 years outside of the current budget cycle. And I'm not thinking that's a legitimate exercise in point of view of Parliament. I agree with the logic of why we do it. I mean, I'm happy with the program. I'm just issue the wording and so on.
It's precisely what the committee should decide on. And if the committee or Parliament agrees to this, it will have the effect of committing Parliament for 3 years. Of course, the Minister of Finance can always, in his Appropriation Act, come up with something different which contradicts this. But I think the intention is that the money should be available for these 2 years to ensure a smooth transition and that everything goes 100% within the HSRC and the incorporation of the institute's functions.
So just sorry to offend Mike for saying chair, and maybe you shouldn't use the word the institute's parliamentary budget allocation. Just say something like the current budget allocation or and maybe the indicative amount in the NDEF. In other words, so we know exactly what it is. Because the way I read this, there's only one budget allocation, that's the current financial year. There's no budget allocation next year, that's called an indicative allocation. So if we want to talk about this, maybe make it clear that's what we mean. We mean the NDEF indicative allocations should be ring fenced for this purpose. Or willing to that effect, which isn't that kind of thing.
And honourable members, on the same point, I thought Honourable Smith was asking for an opinion from my own effort. And I'm glad to agree with him on of principle. You cannot budget for a full budget for an island within industry. The question then you were asking, is it possible? Can it be possible? And we foresee that it may not be possible. That's why they do not give us a comfort. But more than about that, it may not be as I read from his body language, from what he said, that this may be motivation from someone. In the weekend then, that motivation was presented before us, so that we can understand. What is the basis for this clause? Say yes, we agree with that motivation, or we don't agree with that. But as it is, we need clarity. Thank you, sir.
Okay, I think I'm going to end very early once it's so that we don't delay time. Myself, I'm still going to a chairperson's meeting, shall I move it later because it starts at 5:30. I think you must go and review that because it says that members have a problem with the wedding. Because in any event, we're going to finalize this next week when we finalize the legislation next week. You can still make the corrections if necessary. But the members, which is quite understandable, once we have agreed, all of us here, that the institute is being dissolved, once the leadership of the two institutes have agreed that indeed the process has been smoothed out. And now it is, the onus is on you, legal people to read it correctly, that it means what it says. For us, the environment will accept the resolutions that have been arrived at, but we need that to be reflected in the wording of the bill. It should not give double meaning, ambiguity. It must be straight to the point. So, as has been said, it means when you want to clarify that, you must clarify that the empty aside already that already has is in play. You must word it in such a way that we say that now that the institute is moving to agency, where there are some kind of incorporation and financial cushions, then this was reflected in the wording of the MPF statement. Parliament would not be required in the next year to approve again another budget for the institute. I do not know how we are going to word it, but we have understood what we were trying to say. Okay. I'll have it.
And there's a third concern. The admin cost?
Sorry,
the third issue is admin costs, which don't need to be covered seemingly.
Okay. So will you
yes, Stephen, I unfortunately can't answer that. I think it should come from the department to why the whole budget should go over. I cannot answer the
I think you touched on there will still be the fact that moving from a production to production. So there still be some admin cost situation in the operation of the organization. There will be savings from the admin cost that will be moved to strengthen that the teams, just in the citizen and the CEO indicate that they will be able to work for them to strengthen the research process in the IPA. So the savings that will be used
during my briefing, what I understood was that in terms of administration, there would be identified professionals, people of human resource expertise, who must restructure therefore how the administration from ISA gets incorporated into the administration of Shisafsi. I think I'm not quite familiar with the CEO can clarify the information about it.
Secretary, we agree that that is the case. The position of the CEO will not be filled with AISA. After incorporation between AISA and the HSRC, there will be only one CEO, one CFO, and the issues of library, for example, they have to be dealt with at one tender as opposed to two separate tenders. Things like that, I think we'll be able to identify clearly the area so we can be able to have some savings and then send that savings into research funding.
Great.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Right. I think all matters of finance have been dealt with now. I think the only thing now is that you must say, then go and polish out that for next week. We want to finalize the specification next week and come back with all ready to meet there.
Thank you, sir. I wonder if I might just initiate one thing. I don't know whether it's considered an alternative, because the problem we've always had with this clause, even from the early version of what we first discussed, is making provision for a non-existent institute's budget to function. And you're making future provision. It's crazy. And even this now, if you remember it, I'm sure, but I still see the same problem. The other option always, of course, was simply to amend the HSRC Act, that all amendment clause today, that there's such a transitional provision, or have transitional provision which deals with the place of the institute, the non-existent institute, the HSRC. That's still not an option. I mean, you cannot have a repeal bill which has a substantive provision of the same to which amend something else. Is that not possible?
Well,
because I still find this a very messy approach to the problem.
I think these transitional measures can really be addressed by through operations, because they all fall under the Department of Science and Technology. It's not like it's under two different ministries where negotiations might be difficult instead of how to manage it. The minister approves the plan, the annual performance plan, the strategic plan of the agency, and the minister can be able to address those rather than to bring it to Parliament.
Yeah, in the form of regulation.
The one option is to remove this clause of it, that make a vision for it.
Yeah. Anyway, I think they are competent enough to look into it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, thank you very much. The next, I think we must move to the last step of the legislation, which is the appointment of the